Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another show of At Home with Victoria, with your host, Victoria Gaither, and co-host, Michael Kay.
Good evening, everybody. Tuesday, February 7th. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of At Home with Victoria. I am your entertainment co-host, Michael Kay. Our lovely news lady, as you may have seen on Facebook, has been skiing and snow tubing with young children. So she's experiencing the what old people can't do with young people syndrome. She's a little sore, so I gave her the night off tonight, but tonight I'm very, very excited to go ahead and have with me documentary filmmaker, five-time Emmy nominee and Peabody winner, Philip J. Day. He's got a new series coming out on the National Geographic Channel called Party Like, and we're going to hear all about it just a little bit later. But you may have seen this guy a lot of places, National Geographic Channel, Discovery, BBC, Channel 4, The History Channel, originally from the UK and now here in the States, sharing his wisdom and filmmaking expertise with us. But let's not wait any longer. Let's bring Mr. Philip J. Day on the line. Philip Day, so nice to finally meet you.
Thank you very much for the introduction. I feel very grand suddenly, but you're too kind, sir.
Well, you should be, sir. You're my first Peabody winner. I feel like I should bow to the humble gods.
Well, thank you. Much appreciated. It was a nice introduction.
Fantastic. How was your day today? What's happening where you are?
Well, we are celebrating the series with what people call a wrap party, and the fact that it's called, the series is about the greatest parties in history. We decided that we couldn't make it small, so it's probably the biggest party I've ever put on, and the designer to the stars, Dylan Mara, is busying away as we speak with a party that is bigger and grander than anything I've ever done or imagined that I would be doing, frankly. So we have an amazing guest list, and that goes tomorrow night in Santa Monica in California, and I'm looking forward to it, and it's going to be a great end to what's been a very long and arduous task to get the series on air to this place on Thursday night.
Well, it's a fantastic series. I've been privileged to see a little sneak peek that Sherry sent me, and it was the Marie Antoinette, the Queen of France, which was amazing. The opulence and the information that you shared too, I find is fantastic about things about Marie Antoinette that I didn't even know. I knew she was 14, but I thought, 14 back then, I can't believe she was going to these lavish parties and getting drunk off champagne. I mean, they really knew how to party back then, but. Let's walk backwards a little bit. Originally from the UK, where did you get your start in film?
I was at art school, and I took a 3-year Bachelor of Art Honours degree in film and television, and that was in London. And I managed to step out of that straight into a job as a editor for a TV series in the UK. And did my penance as an editor. It's an arduous job, but it's incredibly informative as to how to make films. And I think most people either get in through as a director, either through writing or as an editor, seem to be the obvious ways in. And I was taking the editor route, so I kind of earned my stars and worked my way up the ladder for about 5 years until I started directing, my very first project was a sort of passion project, and made in Japan, and a subject that was kind of dear to me at the time, live theatre, and my mum was in theatre, and I was sort of a big passionate fan of it, so I made a film about Japanese theatre, and managed to make an award-winning film off the bat, and have never looked back 20 years later.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I just want to go ahead and just off the back of that, I think the first start to filmmaking is getting coffee for the other people who are actually filmmaking. That's, I think, how we end up really breaking into it. But your mom, Hazel, actually was an actress and an opera singer, right?
Correct. Absolutely right. Thank you for mentioning her. Yes, she was an extraordinary woman, still is. She's around. It's coming up to her 80th birthday in July, and I will be in London for that and the Olympic Games, so I'm very much looking forward to both events. But yeah, she was an extraordinary influence in my life and a great talent, and I spent my childhood backstage and sometimes on stage, so it was an interesting childhood. And then my dad dragged us off to Africa when I was 11 years old, and everything changed.
Yeah, Zimbabwe's got to be a bit of a stretch from the UK, I would imagine.
Especially at that time, it was, you know, everything was nice and fun, and you know, it was a great place to be. And then suddenly, I found myself in an area where I was probably part of 1%, and 1% were white people, which in itself is great, but it doesn't have to give you a culture shock. So it was a real eye opener to the world, and that I'd been somewhat cloistered and before that, and my eyes were opened. And I think really that those years in Africa from 11 onwards were the reason that I make films today. I think it kind of opened my eyes to the big wide world in which I lived but wasn't aware that I was living in it.
Yeah. You're the youngest of three, right? You've got Martin and who are the other two again?
William, my older brother.
Right.
Martin's a successful one. We all pale in his shadow. He's the world's leading environmental lawyer and has successfully fought against Goliath for every David around the world, from defending Japanese prisoners of war against the Japanese government, British nuclear fuel for excessive leukemias, tobacco industries for excessive lung cancer, all sorts of extraordinary issues that he's fought and often won, not always, but often. So he's great. He's a great brother and a great character to have in the family as a kind of heroic personality, and somebody who's really stuck by his guns, and it's never been about money for him. It's always been about the actual injustice of the little man fighting against the big man. So God bless him.
Absolutely. Huge kudos to him. And that's really funny you should bring that up, actually. I'm going to throw my hat in the ring, Mr. Day. I do a little documentary thing on the side. I have a little show called Tales from the Crypt, and it's just on YouTube. And what it actually chronicles is my partner is suffering from secondary progressive MS, and he's now in hospice care. So we're doing the videos to go ahead and show what end stage kind of is, how it helps with the caregivers, how it helps with those actually suffering through it. But there's a chemical company up here in New Jersey that is rendering a lot of people with these autoimmune deals and stuff. So I, you know, you may have to go ahead and hand me William's number. There's some information that I would love to go ahead and extend to him. Is he actually working here in the States as well, or is he back in the UK?
Just put us right. That was Martin, who's the lawyer, and William, the engineer. But now Martin's a pure British law, so unfortunately,
right.
Law doesn't
probably,
cross borders
yeah.
typically. So. Unfortunately, I can't help you on that one
unless
transfers to Britain.
If you get to know me, buddy, I kid a lot, so it was one of those things. But let's go. I was doing some research on you, and definitely you worked with Katzenberg, Spielberg, David Geffen on the DreamWorks project From Dream to Scream, Ray Liotta, you know, tons of people you've worked with and everything. What has been your most satisfying project to date? Don't include Party Like, because we'll get into that a little bit later. But
yeah, that would sound like too much of a plug at this point.
I really do soon.
But it's a very big question across a 20-year career. So I'm going to plumb for something that was actually very American-based and very. It probably was the reason that I'm living here now. I made a film about the Challenger disaster 15 years on. It was back in 2001, before 9/11 changed the landscape of the world. But it was, for me, probably the you know, really kind of high point in my filmmaking, because I felt like I'd reached a place where I was able to craft not just a document, as in a documentary, but also entertainment as well. And that, you know, sure, it's a tragic story, but, you know, you've got to engage your audience in a dramatic way, let's say that. Entertainment sounds a little crass under the circumstances, but in a sort of dramatic, draw the audience in, get to know the characters. And it was a work that I feel quite strongly saying it now, that it was Emmy nominated, but I think it would have actually won the Emmy that year, except the tragedy of 9/11 happened after it had been finished, after it had been aired, but just before the Emmys. And so, who knows? I mean, maybe it's all in my imagination there, but it was a fine film, and it really got behind the scenes of why they'd launched the Challenger against all the engineers' advice. And the engineers were screaming at the politicians, ultimately, do not launch, there is a problem. And they launched anyway, and we know the rest of the story. I'm sure your listeners do. And, you know, 75 seconds later, it crashed into the Atlantic, killing all on board. Well, that was one heck of a dramatic story, but it was, you know, utterly superseded by 9/11, which made it seem somewhat smaller and less significant. So that was, but it was a great film and certainly a high point. It was for BBC in the UK and for Discovery Channel here in the US. So it's a great learning experience that I got to film on the at NASA launch pad and watch a night launch and such like. So I was wandering around actually on the launch pad just a few hours before it launched. So very great privilege to be a documentary filmmaker. You get to sniff around everybody else's business and then leave them to it at the end of the day and
really,
you know, get on with their business.
Let them sweep up afterwards. if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Philip J. Day. I want to give a big thanks to everybody up in chat. We've got Junior from California, Mar from Nashville, M. Stegan from Alberta, Nelia from Toronto, Canada, and all the brand new guests. But let's segue into Hello, Mr. President, your Peabody win. What was that like?
Well, I was very privileged to be working with a fabulous producer, journalist, a guy called David Taylor, who works out of Leesburg, Virginia. And David was probably still is the world's leading expert on LBJ. And he got a hold of the tapes slightly ahead of the game. He was slightly ahead of the curve. They were released into the public domain, but David's research had given him access to them slightly early. Legitimately, I must point out. And so he was ahead of the curve, and he put forward a proposal that went to Channel 4 Television and the History Channel here. And it was the production company I was working with in London, Mentorn, Baratov Kerry. They asked me, would I be interested in helping David produce it and for me to direct it. And, you know, David was a fabulous journalist, and by that point I'd been recognized as a good director. And so they married us together, effectively. And albeit that, you know, there was inevitable sort of elbow room that we needed to give one another, is that we worked, I thought, incredibly well together and brought together an incredible document about a president under fire. We go from the moment that JFK has been assassinated, and the tapes are available, you know, that day. There was some tapes that were recorded the day after, flying back to Washington, totally fearful that the Chinese, the communists, were involved, and that the nuclear missiles would be flying. And you hear him talking to Mrs. Kennedy in great detail, and it brings it alive so much, hearing somebody's phone conversations as opposed to, you know, the written memoirs, which are edited and pointed for, you know, the historians or whatever. Is that here's the genuine article without being on camera, without performing in any way. This was him at his most natural. And, you know, you get him talking to J. Edgar Hoover, and he asks J. Edgar Hoover if he's being bugged, which is hilarious because he was bugging J. Edgar Hoover. And he was an extraordinary man. He was very misunderstood, I think, in this country, and I think he got a bad lot out of the Vietnam War, which certainly he was, as president, responsible for in some way, but it had actually been JFK who'd proliferated the troops out in Vietnam. And so LBJ, you know, was already in it by the time he took over, and they thought it was a war they could win, and we found out later that they were very wrong. But he was so hated by the American public by the end of his presidency that he couldn't even go out in public without riots and demonstrations against him. The only places he ever appeared was on military camps by the end of his tenancy. And so it was a tragic end to somebody who'd actually done enormous amounts for America. And I think America does forget just how much he'd done for them with civil rights movement and the war against poverty, with things that he brought in at a time when nobody else was talking about that. And I don't think anybody could have done it because he had Texas. He was a true Texan. And so he was able to win over the South. And so all these details come out in that one film. And then we made five others. The series was Emmy Award winning. We had three nominations to that, the Peabody, and it was just recognized as being a fine piece of journalism mixed with a good storytelling way, and you know, I will remain eternally proud of the series.
Yeah. Fascinating. We get emails all the time during the show, Philip, so I'm going to go to a couple questions, if that's okay with you. What do I have? I have Debbie from Detroit that wants to know, which would you value more, the Peabody or the Emmy? Oh, good question.
As a journalist, the Peabody, as a filmmaker, the Emmy. So it depends on which hat I'm wearing. The Peabody is specifically to journalism, and the Emmy is more, shall we say, glamorous and Hollywood. I live in Los Angeles now. It'd probably mean more to the people in L.A. But to be honest, all of those big awards just make you so proud to have been involved, whether they're nominations or actual awards. And so I'm just proud to have got on the map, but it's a fine question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's brilliant, actually, I'm not really one for awards, but I certainly understand when you go through a project that isn't done with such intense scrutiny and attention to detail that sometimes you don't mind a little trophy thrown your way because you know exactly what it takes, and most times you're not working with a huge budget, so everybody's sloughing through mud and shit and trying to go ahead and get the story. But since you're now in LA, I want to go to 2002 with your three-part BBC Discovery series, The Hollywood Machine. That sounds very interesting. I haven't seen it, but I know that Denzel and Hugh Jackman, Jude Law were all in it and stuff. Tell us a little bit about that.
It was a fine project to be involved in. What better thing than to explore in detail, you know, the great art of filmmaking, and the concept of it was, what does it take to be successful in movies? Is that if you draw together, you know, three great filmmakers, you know, producer, writer, and a director, does that guarantee you success? And if not, why not? So what's the DNA of the success of a movie? Where does it come from? How do you guarantee it? What are the guarantees in filmmaking? And so everybody that we spoke to had a $100 million U.S. success, but had also had a flop. And so we tried to sort of piece it together as to what they thought this quintessential DNA of success was. Was there a way of, you know, formalizing that, or was that too crass? And what was it, you know, could you capture lightning in a bottle at will if you were good enough? And, you know, people like Steven Spielberg had to admit that that wasn't the case, is that there is always an element of doubt with art, and you never know what you're going to do is going to be commercially successful. You may have critical success with a film and commercially it's a flop, does that make it a bad film? So it was quite a cerebral. I mean, to be honest, I can't imagine in this day and age it was quite cerebral and probably wouldn't have been commissioned. But at the time, it was a fabulous journey for me. I got to meet some of my great cinema heroes of LA and really learned LA, and I think it was definitely the path down which I intended to follow and laid the groundwork for me arriving in 2005.
Right. I'm going to go back to the chat here for a second. Just remind everybody, in a few minutes, we're going to be taking your questions for Philip J. Day. So go ahead and feel free to go ahead and put them up in chat, or you can go ahead and email them to yahoo.com, Victoria, I'm sorry, At Home with Victoria. But I want to go to, I read this fascinating thing about you, my friend, and it amazes me the level of life experience you have to become a really good historian. But let's go back to 2009. You're filming in the desert of southern Peru on a film, and you had a little trouble with some people.
Yes. Well, that was quite a story. We were making a film about the Nazca lines, and if some of your viewers may know about them, they are a series of lines that can only be seen from high vantage points, these days usually an airplane, and they are sort of drawings in the sand, but on a vast scale. So there's monkeys, there's turtles, there's fish, there's whales, there's people. Some think there's a spaceman drawn in there, and a lot of interest has been drawn to the area over the years. It's a big tourist spot, and if any of your listeners have an opportunity to ever travel down to Nazca, it's a fabulous experience to see them. And you scratch your head and wonder, how did they do them? Well, our journey was all about answering that question: why did they get there? What were they doing? What was their purpose? And so we traveled there, and we were doing the documentary side, which in my terms means that we were interviewing local experts in the field, archaeologists and the geologists and the like, and sociologists who were explaining about the ancient cultures that had lived there. And once we pieced that together, and I often do this with my filmmaking, is that I go and do the documentary side first, where I pick up the information first, piece that together either there and then on site, and then decide what other pictures do I need to get to tell this story. And I'm known for doing a lot of recreations, fairly believable recreations. We have sort of a style that I think is specific to the company and to me, where you don't see too much. It's sort of glimpsed and somewhat not full frame. So you sort of get an idea about it, but you're not given it as some cruddy piece of bad drama. It sort of looks quite cool. But it still needs a drama-sized crew. And we built our crew up slowly but surely from the five of us who were there initially to something like 35, 40 people were staying in this hotel. And we were the only people in town that were filming. Everybody knew that National Geographic's team was in town making a film. And we'd finished filming one night late, and it'd been a hard day, and the next day was going to be another hard day. And so it was just a few hours of sleep. I got to bed about 1 o'clock, and I knew that I had no more than 4 hours sleep ahead of me. My daughter was with me, who was 15 at the time. And she was sleeping in the next room to me at the hotel, and we were on the second floor. And suddenly there's an almighty noise going on downstairs, somebody running around, and they sounded like they were mad and drunk or whatever. And eventually, after this had gone on for what seemed like an eternity, and I was really frustrated because I wanted sleep, I wanted to, get some rest, and this was absolutely troublesome. So I was about to yell at somebody. I didn't care who it was. I was going to yell at them. And so I came outside, and I see my electrician, the guy that's working for me, trying to break down my production manager's door. And I had zero idea what was going on. So I started yelling at him, and he spoke no English at all, and my Spanish is pathetic. So he looked at me and he said, "No problem." And I thought, how can you say that? You're trying to break the door down, and my production manager is female. And then she peeks out from behind the curtains, because, and she said, "Don't worry, Phil. We've been locked in. Somebody's trying to rob us." And at this point, my head's spinning. And cut a long story shorter, is that five guys had scaled a wall at 3 o'clock in the morning with rifles, automatic weapons, and the like, balaclavas, or ski masks, that you call them here.
Right.
Excuse me. And had scaled these 20-foot walls with grappling hooks, climbed in, mugged the assistant. They knew where the assistant doorkeeper was, and mugged her, got her to take them to the management, held guns at the manager's head and the receptionist, and then wandered round from room to room with the gun at the manager's head, looking for the gringos with the cameras, which was basically me and my cameraman. We had all the gear in our rooms. And thank God the manager, this wonderful lady, she said, I have no idea. There are 35 people in my hotel, 50 people in the hotel. I don't know which one's which. You know, I have no idea. All the white people look the same to me, or whatever she would say. And so these guys were going room to room and mugging the people in the room. They were binding them, gagging them, and pistol whipping these poor people as they were sort of looking for us. And thankfully, the driver that was bound and gagged with some kind of paper-based tape, and he had a very sharp, one thumbnail was very sharp because he hadn't cut it or something miraculous. And he was able to cut through his bindings, get free, and rush up and down the corridors yelling, "We're being robbed, we're being robbed." And that's the point I woke up. You know, in Spanish he was saying, "We're being robbed," and I thought he was drunk and being silly. And then the police all turned up with guns raised, as usual, too late. The guys had already got away. But it was a hell of an ordeal. And then from then on in, we had so much police presence, it was insane. We had about five police vehicles with us at all times. And the Minister of Tourism came down to apologize to me profusely. And, oh, my God, it was quite a harrowing affair, I can tell you.
Yeah, that was. I was reading it, actually, on Wikipedia, and I thought, my goodness, I've got to ask him about this because, you know, I am no Indiana Jones. If someone's breaking in, go ahead and take what you need. I've got no problems with that. But, Phil, can I call you Phil? Is that a problem?
You can, indeed. Yeah, it's only my credited name is Philip, but my mom tells me I have to be Philip on my credited names, but I'm Phil to all my friends.
Oh, there we go. Well, I'll take you as a
please
one of your friends. Absolutely.
Please do.
I've got a couple questions up in chat room and stuff. What from Marben Nashville? Which is your favorite film to topic for National Geographic?
Which is my favorite film?
To film, favorite topic to film. What do you find most
passionate
about? I'm sure
topic
that,
to
yeah.
film. Great question. I made a film in the Amazon and. Any opportunity to go to the Amazon is just wonderful, and we rarely do, as you know, normal people in our day-to-day lives. It's not something that's on the top of my bucket list, is jumping into a plane and rushing off down to the Amazon for my holidays. But when I've had cause to, which is twice now, it's just been extraordinary. I've never seen anything like it. It's just an unbelievable place, and it's such a shame that it's so far away from most people that they don't get an opportunity to travel there. But and doing it with a project in mind, you always end up getting taken to places that are really extraordinary in some way, or really off the beaten track. And so you kind of, you know, not just seeing what most tourists, and you know, I'm as much a tourist as anybody else on my holidays. I love going to see the Vatican or wherever it may be. But so as a documentary filmmaker, I love going off the beaten track and getting to places that you wouldn't normally decide to go to for a two-week vacation.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to take another question actually from Nora from Las Vegas. At what age did Peter start making films, and what was his motivation to do so?
I'm going to just correct you on the Philip, but rather than Peter.
I'm sorry, Philip. I'm so sorry. it is. I'm reading too fast.
A minor slip of no consequence. We all know who's talking about this, so no, that's absolutely fine. So the question was again.
The question was, what age did you start making films, and what was your motivation?
Oh, I see. Sorry. I got thrown by the name thing. I was. As a director, I was 28 when I started when I made my very first television documentary film. But I started making films when I lived in San Francisco. I started, you know, making little Super 8 films when I was in my, what was I, 19.
Right.
So it's like anything. The earlier you start, the easier it is. The later you leave it, the more complex it is. It's like language or learning to ski or anything. It's just so much easier. So my advice for any budding filmmakers out there is don't be shy. Get a camera. Go and think of a story. Go out and shoot it. We've all got the technology that doesn't have to cost a fortune. And go out and make those films, because there's nothing like experience.
Absolutely, and I don't know how you feel about this, but I think the YouTube revolution has certainly allowed a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't have. I think the technology has got just so simple now that anybody can upload anything from their phone, and on, you know, in 20 minutes, 5 minutes, it's up on YouTube and running. So I think it lends a lot to new people. How does YouTube affect the industry right now? You know, yourself being, you know, a very revered filmmaker versus those amateurs and stuff like that. Do you find it at all threatening or what have you?
Well, I think you have to have a tough hide to not be threatened by the amount of material out there, and thankfully my mom bestowed on me a tough hide, so I've never been concerned about competition. In fact, quite the opposite. I think it's a great thing. I think it makes me keep on my toes. It makes me stop getting lethargic, and I never think that I've made it in any shape or form. I'm always working to do better work next time, and I think most people in most art forms, whether it's music, art, filmmaking, music, classical music or pop music, you know, they're constantly pushing themselves. And when you stop doing it, it's time to retire. So I don't feel like retiring for a good long time. I feel pushed on and inspired by what I see, the inventiveness of other people. And, you know, quite honestly, I borrow liberally from it wherever I can. If I see a great idea, I think, what a great idea. So I borrow ideas wherever they seem appropriate to the material that I'm working with. So I'm never one to be fearful of it, nor does it stop me doing anything. It has, however, changed the marketplace, undoubtedly. But in fact, what's interesting is that what we're seeing at the moment is even more channels are opening. I mean, you know, history's now got H2, National Geographic's got Wild, Google Channel's about to open 300 channels at once. There's always room for material to be made. How much money you make from it, and how, you know, can you earn a living out of it, becomes, you know, a question. But fortunately, there's always a new technology out there that allows you to make it cheaper. People that use the 5D Canon camera a lot these days, which is a high definition format on a stills camera, and it gives you great, you know, you can use great lenses, and ultimately filmmaking is about pointing a great piece of glass at a scene that you want to film and recording it onto a format that gives you a decent end result. It's not it's not terribly complicated, and thankfully technology's made it ever more accessible and easy. But I think the great advantage that I have, that others, you know, have to earn their spurs on, is storytelling. And
right.
That's, you know, something that I think as I write and then I direct and I produce, and I think as a storyteller, I've got the benefits of years of experience, and how to hone down good storytelling is an art form in itself. And, you know, hopefully one day I'll be excellent at it. I think I'm pretty good at it right now, so I've got room to maneuver, that's for sure.
Yeah, I find good storytellers actually do one major thing, and that's make people care. People, you know, making people care either about a topic or about an issue. I think that's what the storyteller ends up eventually doing. Philip, let's go to one more question from the chat room. Gina from California. Do all of your films require significant efforts on your part for funding, or are you sought out to make them now?
Both. There's no easy route to that first check ever.
Mm-hmm.
There's always hoops to jump through, regardless of the filmmaker. I'm sure even Mr. Steven Spielberg has struggles to get budgets underway, you know, when they're quite so much money. He'll get it a lot easier than I do. every time you make a film, there are hoops that you've got to jump through, and thankfully you're not only as good as your last film, but you've only got about two or three films behind you that people care about. What have you made in the last few years? And thankfully the bar is fairly high with my work, so that I don't have to delve back too far into my past to show them an ace and say, hey, look, it could be as good as this or better. I've been sought out quite a lot to people will come to me with a greenlit project and say, would you be prepared to make this? As long as I have elbow room to shape it and, you know, work on the material under my own steam, with
right.
my own creativity, then it's quite exciting that, because it means that I don't have to go out and do the hard sell, which is sometimes... It's a painful process, knocking on doors with a project, no matter where you are in your career. You know, it's never easy, and it's never particularly nice, and no can be annoying and frustrating. But I've always taken the view, never take no as an answer. It's just a hiccup.
Yeah. You just have to ask for a different answer. But let's go to Party Like now. Like I said, Sherry sent me a copy of one of the episodes, and really brilliant, brother. Now on this project, you're executive producing, you're directing, you're writing, you're the camera operator. You made some cookies for the cast. I think you did craft services. But I know your company Edge West is very very active. But tell us. To me, I think people won't understand it until they actually see it. But tell us the concept, how you came up with the concept for Party Life.
I've been fascinated with history throughout my life. I was a big history buff as a kid. But I've noted that there's not a great demand for history in its old form of here's a story that you should listen to. So you have to sort of find ways to bring history up to date, and you know, often as not, like we're seeing these gladiator films right now that where they're using kind of a lot of sex and a lot of violence and new techniques of filming that make it spectacular and you can't resist it. So that's one method. Well, in this case, I was fascinated by the idea that we as human beings, we've been doing the same thing for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. And yes, that you're probably thinking right now, but also we've partied, we've celebrated, and we celebrate, you know, from cavemen onwards. And we've got evidence of cavemen celebrating, where they'd have a big kill of, say, an elephant or something like that, and they'd get the entire tribe round, and that they would they'd find hallucinogenics, and they would build big fires, and they would cook their meat, and they would stay absolutely focused on celebrating for as long as they possibly could, and whether it be summer solstices, winter solstices, weddings, chiefs, you know, the death of a chief or whatever, or the birth of some great king's son, there has been celebrations throughout time. And some of them have been so epic that they've gone on for days and days and days. Some of the costs to celebrate have been in their multi-millions in today's terms. And as I started to investigate the theme of this universal celebration, I realized that there was a project here for sure. It was just, how did I dress it up to make it palatable to a modern audience? You can't just, you know, give them a list of things. It has to be, there has to be a story behind it, and there has to be a reason to go to it. And so that was the initial genesis of it, which was probably about, 2.5 years ago, I came up with a concept for it. And then about a year ago, December of 2009, it was, December of 2010, it was commissioned by National Geographic to do. We suggested a six-parter. They agreed upon a three-part miniseries to see how well it does. And see how, you know, what the ratings were, and if it rates well, pretty certain they'll be back for more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's I found so many tips that I think I forgot to think about them. One of the points that you really brought up was back in the heyday, Marie Antoinette and stuff, and her infamous orgy/raves at the Opera House. The thing that I really found interesting is that the wealthy didn't bathe frequently. I think one of your historians mentioned maybe once a month. Some bathed just once a year. Now, I certainly hope that does not include, you know, just taking a rag to a couple parts just to go ahead and make sure all that stuff is clean, but when you couple that with, you know, a 3.5-foot wig and a 40-pound dress with, you know, 5 feet wide, this basic, you know, drag queen RuPaul-looking 7-foot Marie Antoinette at the age of 15 walking in there stinking like onions. I never would have thought of that. And then from the heat, from the candles to the closed environments, I thought, wow, that must have been one funky party place.
It is extraordinary when you think about it that, you know, the rich would have bathed maybe once a month, but the poor certainly didn't. And the idea of hygiene in our minds today, we cannot even fathom that for a second. So God knows what it must have smelled like. But apparently they used an awful lot of perfume to cover up the smells. So you kind of got this very strong perfume with this very odorous body smell. It must have been particularly horrible. So when we see these images of decadent France, it's an interesting one to think about. Thank God we don't have Smellorama in our movie house as well.
Absolutely. Well, that, and between the rotting vegetables and the hair and all that stuff, and then, of course, I think I found interesting too, and correct me if I'm wrong in understanding this, but their cocaine back then was sugar. Am I right? Because it
was
from Haiti. And
effectively, you know, before the advent of sugar, there was, you know, they had sweet things like alcohol's obviously got its own natural sugars, and fruit's got its own natural sugars. But sugar wasn't in any way a known quantity in Europe until the sugar beet was discovered in Haiti. It was cultivated there. It wasn't actually found there, but it was cultivated there, and it was brought back en masse, and the slave industry and enabled sugar to be made, and then enabled sugar to be brought back on the Caribbean. The Caribbean was the place where they could make this the sugar en masse. So suddenly, across Europe, you had the sugar fixation, which translated into everything that they ate, was just so sweet. I mean, we eat sweet things today, but they were incredibly sugary. So it was sort of a little bit like the Red Bull revolution.
That's exactly what I was saying. That's vodka and Red Bull you got there. You got champagne and you got, you know, sugar-covered strawberries. Everybody's bouncing off the walls.
Absolutely. And I don't think they had the sort of the same narcotics that we have today of, you know, ecstasy and cocaine and marijuana. But, they, you know, they certainly, the alcohol was certainly their big high along with sugar. So I'm sure that they were bouncing off the walls just as much as they do today.
Absolutely. Now, Party Like is actually set to drop on February 9th on the National Geographic Channel. So you want to go ahead and pay attention, check your local listings. But how exciting is that to have another show on?
Oh, this one's been such an amazing journey for me. It really has. I really appreciate National Geographic pushing the boat out with allowing us the opportunity to do this. It's quite risque. It's fairly racy. You know, these are decadent parties, past and present. The story goes that our maestro Dylan Mara, who's the party planner to the stars here in Hollywood, puts on events all over California and Nevada and Miami and places like that. And he's constantly looking for inspiration, so he constantly delves back into the history books. And it's when he delves into the history books that we, in the program, have the opportunity to delve back with him. And so one of his shows is the Playboy Masquerade Party. And so he was looking for inspiration for it and decided that Marie Antoinette was his inspiration. So that's the opportunity in the film to go back to tell the story of Marie Antoinette. So it kind of segues sweetly backwards and forwards between him trying to make his event work and something spectacular and the story of Marie Antoinette, told as a sort of flowing theme through it. It was a cool idea. It's got a lot of traction in a lot of places. I think there's an interest in understanding this culture. It's an exciting era. We all party and we can all relate to it. So it seems to have got a lot of interest out of it. So it's exciting. Yeah. It's an exciting time.
Absolutely brilliant production values in that. Please give your editor a hug. I mean, that must have been a huge fun bit to go ahead and put together. And for those, like I said, National Geographic on the 9th, go ahead and check it out, Party Like. Yeah, I found it seamless, actually, the way you walked back and forth through time. I thought that was wonderful. A lot of your crowd scenes, brilliant CGI work. Just really a joy to watch. Really a joy to watch, Philip.
Well, I appreciate the accolades, and that I really do, and I'm just hoping that as many of your listeners tune in, because we're excited about the series, and we'd love to get as many people. See, you know, if people hate it, throw me the criticism. I can be reached at phil@edgewest.com, and if you've got anything you want to say, I'd be good or bad. Please send me your comments. I'm always fascinated to hear what people have to say about it, good or bad. It matters not.
Fantastic. Philip, we're running out of time, but tell us where we can go ahead and find some of your past documentaries and stuff. Can you just go on, say, nationalgeographic.com and look it up in the archives?
NatGeoTV.com has got a ton of stuff. Our website is edgewest.com, and on there you'll see some of the films we've been making over the last 4 years. We don't have permission to show them in full, but they'll get the titles, and then they can go on to the NatGeoTV.com site. And they've got Born to Rage on there, which is one of my favorites from last year, with Henry Rollins, the ex-punk from Black Flag, presenting a show about why men are so violent. That's on YouTube as well. You find a lot of stuff on YouTube. The Crime Lords of Tokyo was one we made last year about an investigative film about the Yakuza, the crime lords in Tokyo, which is, again, on YouTube.
Okay, fantastic. Philip, please give a shout-out to Dylan, too. How did you meet Dylan?
Dylan Mara, he is a force of nature. He will find you. we were looking to which parties we were fascinated by, and we found out the Masquerade was happening this time last year, and we contacted Playboy. They told us something about it, and we said, great, can you put us in touch with the event planner? And Dylan and Edge West, my company, struck up a great friendship, which is strengthened all the time. We're actually coming up with some great new television ideas with him, and some of the stars that he represents, some of the big DJs that he works with, and that kind of thing. So he really is a force of nature. Any parties, he's a candy masquerade. He does the all the candy events for the Karma Foundation. So great talent. And if any of your listeners get an opportunity to attend one of his parties, then don't miss it. It's very, very exciting.
Fantastic. Everybody, you've been listening to Philip J. Day. Once again, go ahead and find him on www.edgewest.com. If you have any comments for his upcoming party, like, it's LIKE on the National Geographic Channel. Buddy, we're running out of time. Philip, I can't thank you so much for stopping by, and I hope you had fun with us.
I certainly did. Certainly
fantastic.
Did.
Much, much luck, much love your way, my friend. And once again, I will remind you that you're always at home here with Home of Victoria. So if you've got anything else you want to go ahead and shout out or promote, we're always here for you. So just take that to the bank.
Thank you so much for your time, Michael. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you, and I've really enjoyed myself. Thank you.
Fantastic, buddy. You have a great night. Hugs all your way.
Thanks so much. Appreciate that.
Take care.
Good night to
Bye-bye
you.
Bye
bye.
Philip J. Day on Home of Victoria, Peabody winner, 5-time Emmy Award nominee, fantastic man, interesting story. Thank God he got out of that hostage situation. Wasn't that a story? Holy crap. Anyways, want to thank all for listening. Want to thank Gina Kelly Diva in California. Want to thank all the brand new guests. Want to thank Marby in Nashville for producing an excellent chat room. Nelia from Toronto, Nora Mayer from Los Angeles. Much thanks for tuning in. So, once again, Philip J. Day, brilliant man. Going to go to the studio here. Going to play a little song on the way out of here. We had a consensus here, and I think we're going to end up with Connecticut-born Jesse Terry. Jesse Terry with Empty Seat on the Plane. I'll see you on Facebook, guys, in a little bit. But thanks for tuning in to another edition of At Home with Victoria. This is Jesse Terry with Empty Seat on a Plane. Good night.
They were once grounded for miles. Now they are constellations burning like us, sipping the wine, tangled like my thoughts churn. Look up above your head at the light. You could be there instead in the sky, or somewhere in the sky. There's an empty seat, an empty. Your name rang out somewhere in the sky, there's an empty sea, an empty sea, on a 767, bound for Austin in the fall. No, we're coming up on with her. You can't stand the cold at all, but you chose. Look up above your head at the light. You could be there still in the sky, or somewhere in the sky. There's an
At Home with Victoria, an interactive news and entertainment show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Download us on iTunes as a free podcast and like us on Facebook. I'm Shelly Rand, musician and announcer for At Home with Victoria. Download my CD on iTunes and Amazon and friend me on Facebook.